Have you finished your personal statement yet? Now's the perfect time to get it professionally reviewed by a medical school HQ expert advisor. We have former directors of admissions, admissions officers, and the like on our small team of amazing people. They have the inside knowledge from reading thousands and thousands and thousands, tens, if not 100,000 personal statements going through the process and setting up the process for their whole committee. They know exactly what medical schools look for and the common red flags that can get your entire application thrown out. Take advantage of our flash sale right now, going through May 6th, up to 6,000 characters reviewed for just $150. That's a $75 discount on our regular price. Go to editmyps.com. Again, that's editmyps.com. The pre-med year, session number 515. Hello, and welcome to The Pre-Med Years, where we believe that collaboration, not competition, is key to your success. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Gray, and in this podcast, we share with you stories, encouragement, and information that you need to know to help guide you on your path to becoming a physician. Welcome to The Pre-Med Years. Thank you so much for joining me. I have an exciting guest today, someone who I met at a conference and asked him to be on the podcast, and he is here. He did not disappoint. We talk about his journey to medicine, his journey to media, and kind of where the future lies in terms of post-COVID life and anti-science, anti-doctor, anti-whatever rhetoric. I have a great conversation with Dr. Sanjay Gupta. Before we jump in, though, I want to talk about the MCAT Minute brought to you by Blueprint MCAT. If you are struggling, trying to figure out where to start, go to blueprintmcat.com, sign up for their free account, register an account, and use their free study planner tool. Let the tool know when you're planning on taking the MCAT, what your schedule looks like, and let it create a custom plan for you that you can follow all for free. Go to blueprintmcat.com. All right, let's go ahead and say hello to Dr. Sanjay Gupta. Dr. Sanjay Gupta, welcome to the pre-med years. Thanks for joining me.
I've been looking forward to this, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Looking forward to it. I think maybe a little bit more than you. My favorite question to start, when did you first realize you wanted to be a doctor?
I remember this actually pretty clearly. I was 13 years old. My grandfather, my mom's dad, had gotten really sick. He had a stroke and he was in the hospital. And nobody in my family was a doctor. So I didn't really have that exposure to medicine. And it was kind of one of those things where my parents are both engineers, both mathematics, you know, that was their discipline. And that was kind of what I thought I was going to do. I think that everyone just thought that I would do that. And then I went and spent a lot of time with my grandfather in the hospital. Mm. And really, you know, I was young still, but I sort of saw this career, you know, people taking care of each other and the doctors. I still don't know if his doctors thought I was annoying or inquisitive, but I asked a lot of questions, and yeah. I think that was it. I was pretty hooked at that point.
Yeah. So basically the same story that most pre-meds have is like some personal or family illness injury that's like, oh, there's this whole world out here where I can help people. So it's so funny. I think.
Yeah. Although it's interesting because I think a lot of people, I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's data on this, but I think a lot of people of my generation, their parents or somebody in their family was a doctor.
Yep.
And they had that sort of family tug toward it. And at least when I went to med school, that's what I heard from a lot of my classmates.
Yeah.
So that was just a little bit different. And also, you know, if you're coming from a family of engineers saying, hey, I want to go to med school and then do a residency, for people who aren't in that world, the idea of that's a lot of school,
a lot
of tuition, a lot of time, you know, is something they have to get their heads around.
Yeah. And I think you did a BSMD program where you went to University of Michigan, kind of combined applying for undergrad and medical school together. Is that correct?
That's right. Yep, I did. It was called Interflex.
Okay.
Not Interflex, which is its most common mispronunciation.
Yeah.
But Interflex was a program at Michigan. I guess there are several around the country.
Yeah.
Where it basically, you know, depending on when you started, you could take a year or two off of your time and you're automatically accepted into medical school from high school.
What was the goal behind that? Was that just making it faster, less tuition?
My goal or their goal?
your goal.
Yeah, I mean, look, Ryan, I mean, to be perfectly honest, so if you kind of get the backdrop now with my parents, they're kind of like, okay, this takes a long time, this whole thing. If we could save time, we could save money. Why wouldn't you apply for this?
Yeah.
I was 16 years old. Now I'm a parent of kids who are older than that, and I know that they don't know for certain what they want to do. So I think making that decision at 16 was... it's not a reflection of maturity as much as it is, you know, your brain just isn't developed to the point where you can make those sorts of decisions. So the thinking was that my parents said this would be a good idea to save time and money.
Yeah. Have you ever looked back on that decision and go, I wish I would have taken some time off. I wish I would have slowed down a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I mean, it's a little bit of a non-intuitive thing. I think when you're accepted to medical school right out of high school, my college experience was different, I think, as a result. I got to take classes that I probably wouldn't have taken because I would think, oh, how's this going to help me for medical school? You know, back in those days, it was, you know, a pretty hardcore science curriculum that you were sort of expected to follow. I think it's changed a lot, frankly, over the last few decades. But at that time, I ended up probably taking classes I otherwise wouldn't have. There was an urge to slow down, I think, at times, but I did get to sort of branch out, if you will, in ways that maybe I otherwise wouldn't have.
Yeah, no, that's a good part of it. I know Mount Sinai has a very similar program that you apply to as a sophomore. And that's the impetus is, instead of going and studying for the MCAT and taking biochemistry, get into med school and then go figure out what else you're passionate about. So I like those types of programs. They're interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
So your grandfather has a stroke, obviously, neurology related type experience. Do you think that was the draw for you to neurosurgery, or were there other things that you experienced in medical school that's like, oh, like I want to do that?
No, that wasn't the draw, interestingly enough. And when I started, you know, medical school, sort of, you know, partway through Interflex, I thought I was going to do pediatrics. Once I got on the wards and did rotations there, I just always felt that the pediatric doctors were some of just the best doctors in the hospital. And the reason being that I think it was something about children that was just caring for sick children was so galvanizing, you know, and some of the other services, it seemed like people were like, you know, ready to get out of there as quickly as they could. Whereas the pediatricians were always like, how can I help? How can I, you know, I'm staying to help, you know, take care of these kids. And I just thought, look, if you're going to do this field of medicine, do something that you're really passionate about. And so peds was, I think, my thinking, at least initially.
Yeah. And then what was that exposure?
So that what got happened, you there? Yeah. Right? Yeah. Good question. Well, and then like I'm pretty fickle, I guess, in retrospect. I hadn't really thought about it, but then I actually did surgery rotations when I was in, you know, my third and fourth years. And I did like surgery a lot. I liked being in the operating room. I liked the technical aspects of it. I felt like it was something that I was good at. You know, when you feel like you are able to have some skills in a particular area, you gravitate toward that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, interestingly, Ryan, I started in general surgery thinking I very much wanted to do transplant surgery.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated by immunology. And I thought, okay, immunology and surgery, transplant surgery, that makes perfect sense. So I started actually in general surgery and I switched to neurosurgery my second year.
Interesting.
So a couple of big changes in my career, you know, and again, I think this gets back to the first question you asked. You're pretty young. I'm making these decisions, 22 years old, and my kid's not quite 22, but again, it's like, that's a lot to ask of somebody to make those decisions. I think most people make them, stick with them. Great. I ended up sort of switching from peds to general surgery to neurosurgery.
Yeah. So again, like, why neurosurgery? What was it about the brain that seems like it fascinated you then and continues to fascinate you now?
I think it was two things, really. Once I did a rotation in neurosurgery and spent time with the neurosurgeons, my decision was pretty clear. I did that after I was already a resident. And I think it was a couple things. One is that the brain is just... It's very meta, right? Yeah. To just like talk about operating on the brain. I mean, I thought that, you know, 30 years ago when I first started doing this, and I still think that. Yeah. It's just, there's something, it's a tremendous privilege to say that, look, we're, you know, this thing that constitutes you, your brain, the most enigmatic 3.5 pounds of tissue in the universe, we're going to spend our lives trying to understand it better. We're not going to totally understand it, but we're going to, there's never going to be a shortage of things to try and understand about the brain.
Yeah.
I think that was quite attractive just in terms of a curious mind. But I also, you know, going back to the technical aspects, you know, I find that there's surgeons, you know, and I'll simplify for a second because there's obviously a great diversity of surgeons, but there are definitely people in my class who were, came at it from almost athletics. They were smart, you know, they did well in school. It wasn't that, it's just that what they were doing when they weren't doing that was playing basketball, doing athletic things, all that. They were, you know, that was their lifestyle. Other people were much more scientific minded, you know, they were in the lab, but both types of people are in neurosurgery. And I think I had sort of a combination of both. I really like sports. I really like doing things with my hands. Neurosurgery was arguably, from a technical standpoint, the most challenging operations. And I thought that I was good at it, good enough at it, I should say, you know, to gravitate towards that strength.
Yeah. Looking back on your training, medical school, residency, et cetera, what was the hardest thing for you going through that process?
That's a good question. Well, I will say this, and I mean this with honesty, I do look back at that experience very fondly overall. Just as a general rule, because I think, you know, the rap is, you know, certainly when we were training that, you know, it's 100 hours a week and you're, you know, how do you have a life? I think the biggest challenge, I think, like I'm a total family guy. I'm married. I have three teenage daughters, and I kind of knew that I was that kind of guy probably early in life. You know, I'm just, that's my personality. I wasn't some, you know, big party guy, you know, whatever it might be. But when you kind of know that you're a family guy, the hardest part in some ways, you have to postpone certain aspects of your life. You don't have to, but you're just so busy during residency. Yeah. You don't think that you can do something that's meaningful in terms of raising a family. At least I didn't at that point. I want to just be clear. There are people who've done it and they've done a remarkably good job. I have friends who had families and kids during residency. I was blown away by it. For me personally, I just felt like I was so into my residency that it would have been hard for me to give the attention that I thought that deserved. So you end up postponing life, I think, a bit. There's a prolonged adolescence about it. There can be fun aspects of that, but I think it was probably as well the hardest thing. You see a lot of your friends sort of progressing in life faster than you are.
Yeah. One of the most common questions that comes up when I'm talking to other physicians is that work-life balance. Now, obviously, on top of being a physician, you're a news person, a personality, doing lots of other things. How do you find that balance, and what skills or tools do you utilize to maintain that family and life balance?
Well, I think when it comes to bifurcating a career, I'll start there. You know, and I think a lot of people, and it's becoming more common to have sort of bifurcated careers a little bit. You know, I'm a medical person, neurosurgeon, but I do media. There's people who do, you know, X and Y, and sometimes those things are very related, sometimes not as much. I think one valuable thing that I've learned from all this, and someone kind of gave me this insight early on in my career, is that, and it's going to sound obvious, but to enact it requires you to be deliberate. You have to just be really honest about what you're going to be able to deliver to each of those jobs in this case. You know, and that can be as didactic as how much time, what do you think your compensation should be, you know. And I went and had conversations with all my partners in neurosurgery at the university. I had conversations with a lot of my team at, you know, the media companies, and just said, hey, this is what I'm trying to do. This is my life. I operate every Monday.
Yeah.
I see patients in the office on Thursdays. I operate every other Friday. You know, that's my life. And, you know, and so everyone's sort of in on it, as opposed to you or anybody listening, frankly, because I know the personality types. You think you want to give 100% to each thing, and you can't do it.
Yeah.
And again, that sounds obvious, but you're going to end up not doing a very good job either. And the jack of all trades sort of phenomenon. I think in terms of work life balance, I guess, you know, this is just my own insight. I think I got to be humble about this. Everyone lives their life differently, but I made it a point early on of not throwing up walls between my work life and my family life. I think a lot of times people, I'm home from the office and I don't talk about work anymore. You know, and for me, you know, I travel, I go cover a war, cover a natural disaster, do a really fascinating operation, you know, whatever it might be. as my kids grew up, that's part of our bonding time. I would tell them these parts of my life. And I think they found it interesting. And oftentimes when you're raising three teenage girls, you get mocked a lot for the things you've done. But yeah. But I just think that letting them in on your life as opposed to throwing up a wall is probably how I would best summarize family life balance adage that I live by.
Yeah, I love it. So you're a physician, you're successful by all accounts in society, and then you decide, I want more at some point in your life. What was the impetus to go join a media network and be more than just a physician?
This was pretty, in some ways, serendipitous, you know, but there is a connective tissue here. You know, I think like a lot of physicians, nurses, you know, people who are in the healthcare world, you know, I became interested in health policy during med school, during even the end of college. There was a class that I wrote a paper on, and it got me hooked on thinking about this. And I started writing for magazines and just, you know, late teen, early 20 level writing. It was nothing, you know, to write home about, but it got me interested. And ultimately I went and applied for a thing known as a White House Fellowship, which is a kind of a mid-career level fellowship that where people go to the White House and you work in the executive branch. It's a leadership fellowship. And my thing that I really focused on there was health policy. Mm-hmm. And when I left that, I had met a lot of people in media who were interested in these topics, wanted me to talk about it, but I was not really that focused on doing any kind of media. I was on faculty at the University of Michigan. And then I left to take a job at Emory in Atlanta, which was also the headquarters of CNN. And I ran into some of the same guys. I literally actually ran into them at an airport, some of the same guys who I had met at the White House. And they said, hey, do you want to talk about health policy on television? Do you want to do what we were talking about a few years ago?
Yeah.
And I thought, okay. So I was going to, you know, Ryan, it was going to be like a probably like weekend morning show, Sunday morning show, talking head panel. That was the original sort of thinking. And most of my life was going to be neurosurgery. 3 weeks after I started, 3.5 weeks, 9/11 happened. This was 2001. And they basically looked at me and said, hey, you know, we're probably not going to be talking about health policy for a while.
Yeah.
But you are a doctor working at an international news network, and look what's happening in the world. Do you want to, you know, talk about this stuff, anthrax even? And then I ended up covering the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and, you know, just about every conflict and natural disaster since then.
Yeah. I think the biggest takeaway that I get listening to you is that you have been willing to explore passions and be very intentional about it. It sounds like of not kind of pigeonholing yourself as a neurosurgeon, as a doctor, and that's what you do and you keep your head down, but exploring other things. Would you say that's kind of a fair kind of critique of your path?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think what you're saying is right. I think there's two ways to look at that. One is, you know, to be open to new ideas and not pigeonholing yourself, like you say. But I think the other thing is as doctors or probable doctors that are listening, you know, it's a big field.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, how much we consider pigeonholing versus just widening the aperture of what is possible within your field, I think the outcome is the same, but I think there's two different ways of looking at it. If you were to ask me what my passions are today, I think they're the same passions that I had 25, 30 years ago, which is still health and, you know, being a doctor, but also the policy of health and how we think about the country's health, you know, a more public health sort of lens on things. That's always what I've been interested in. I started writing about policy because I felt like, again, clinicians should be part of that discussion. When I was writing about this in the late 90s, I mean, it was easy to get published because nobody in the medical field was really writing about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, those passions are the same. I've just widened the aperture, if you will.
Yeah. All the exploration that you've done throughout the years now, still a physician practicing. What do you think that the pre-med student listening to this that is going to go through training and come out as an attending at some point in the future, what challenges are they going to face that are different than you faced coming up?
Well, that's a really important question. I mean, I think that I don't know that they're necessarily different challenges, but I think some challenges have been amplified and they'll continue to be amplified. I mean, fundamentally, if you're practicing in the United States, you are joining a system that spends about $4 trillion a year to run. And, you know, if you look at metrics that I think matter and metrics that history will judge us on, we don't fare very well. So that's a problem. Yeah. And I think that's it's a challenge. It's a worthy challenge. And I think that as you know, you look at what has been happening in all sorts of different fields, there's going to be an increased desire to address that. You know, I mean, you can't continue to spend that kind of money with these outcomes. So what are you going to do about that? Part of it's going to come from the great scientists and advancing therapies and making things less invasive and shorter times in hospitals. But I think a lot of it's going to be in terms of how we think about what constitutes good health. Do we focus on, you know, all the things, you know, and I think most people who probably think about medicine in any way, shape or form know that we are a very sick society. And you know, in a way, it's a society that is spending so much because of these high rates of obesity and diabetes and things like that. That's probably gonna be the biggest challenge, I think, and the biggest opportunity, because I think we can make some significant inroads into addressing that challenge.
Yeah. I think kind of similar to the pigeonholing that a lot of people see when they get out in their career and like, I'm a doctor and that's all I do. A lot of pre-med students are kind of bright-eyed, bushy-tail, I want to change the world. And then they kind of lose that through their training. How much can a single person going through this training amplify their voice to make a difference, to be the person that goes and makes change and changes our healthcare system and is helping be the change agent for all of this?
I think I have two schools of thought on this, and it's funny because I think if you would have asked me this 25 years ago, I would have answered differently. But now that I have kids of my own of this age, it does change my entire perspective on everything, Ryan, I'm telling you. But I think, first of all, I think there's lots of opportunities to make meaningful change in healthcare, because first of all, it is ripe for change. But also, you know, some of the most meaningful work that I've done has been work that I've done overseas, you know, being able to export some of the incredible resources of a country like the United States and make a real difference overseas. I don't think I'm at all being Pollyannish or in any way when I say, look, I mean, if you're curious about making a change, you've picked the right field. I mean, you make the people who are going into medicine, they make a change every day. And I know that's something that, you know, that's what my parents would tell me. Truth is, like, you are going to become the most important person to countless people you've never even met. I mean, you'll be the most important person in their lives as a doctor, as a healthcare person. It's amazing. I mean, I've done all these things in my life. I go to a restaurant with my kids and, you know, the person who is in the booth over kind of leans over, and I didn't see them when I walked in, one of my patients, and spends the next 10 minutes telling my kids now, who are these teenage girls, you know, his positive reflections of our relationship because I was his doctor. Where else in society does that happen?
Yeah.
I tell you, most of it's the opposite in society nowadays. So yeah, you get to make a change every day, you know, in your life. And that's what I would tell my own kids if they were thinking about going into medicine. They're a little young for it yet, but you know, if they said that, that's what I would tell them.
Yeah. What skills do you think someone coming up nowadays needs to be a great physician? Obviously, through the pandemic, we've seen a lot of distrust in science, distrust in experts, distrust in medicine, that I think is amplified the more we kind of go along. What for a student coming up now, what can they do? A class they can take, things that they can do to make sure that how they communicate and what they communicate helps kind of bridge that divide?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in those same polls that talk about distrust in science, one thing that always jumps out at me is that among the most trusted people in society are people's own individual physicians. Yeah. So, you know, whereas, you know, ahead of a big scientific organization such as CDC or whatever, trust may have gone down, people's personal physicians, personal medical teams are still among the very, the most trusted in society. So, you know, keep that in mind. It's all is not lost in this regard. But I think one other stat that sort of jumped out at me during the pandemic, and I think maybe you and I even talked about it when we were at that event together, but scientists and medical people had increasingly been seen as arrogant. And this was something that's been building, I guess, even pre-pandemic. But the idea that scientific people are seen as arrogant, I think is probably part of the issue here in terms of the mistrust. It's not the whole issue, but in terms of what people can do about it, I think it's, you know, I remind my own residents and medical students that, especially if you're taking care of patients in the hospital, you're taking care of someone at a very vulnerable time in their lives. The picture that you're getting of the person is not who they are typically, because this is a very unusual situation they are now in the hospital, right? Sometimes very worried about living or dying or whatever it may be. And so the humility that I think most, frankly, physicians have needs to really manifest. I mean, medicine there's a humbling sort of a humility to the training process, or even the scientific process. You have to put forth a theory, then you have to test it over and over again and see if you're right, and, you know, figure out your conclusions. There's a humility to the scientific process, but I think sometimes the way people interact with each other lacks that. So we think of medicine like we think of math. Math, 2 + 2 = 4. There's an absolute. Yeah. Medicine's not that way. It's a probabilistic sort of field. And I think to always be able to embody that in your language and your communication, I think is important. We're not certain of many things in life. And, you know, I think we just have to make sure that we don't come off as arrogant or too didactic.
Yeah. When you look at your career as a physician, as someone in media, helping communicate science and healthcare, what do you want your legacy to be?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't think about that much. You know, I think I'll be dead, right? So it's like, what do I care about the legacy? You know, I mean, I know I'll be dead. So at that point, we're talking about these topics.
Yeah.
But I think that what I was, I, certainly being a good family person, you know, a good husband, a good dad, as I said to you early on, I kind of always envisioned myself being that person. And I do consider it one of the great privileges of my life to be able to do this, to have a family. So that would be a big part of the legacy. But I think that what I really try to do more than anything is explain hard things to people, explain complicated concepts and do complicated things, you know, in the operating room and that aspect of medicine. You know, I think societies move forward by constantly pushing the boundaries. And I think that's what I tried to do, I think, in my fields. You know, when I'm explaining things to people, it's to allow larger and larger percentages of people to understand a concept, helps move society forward. In the operating room, just refining those skills over and over again could help someone heal. I guess, I don't know if that's a long legacy, I guess, but I think I was never a guy who liked to sit on the sidelines. I like to get in there and do something,
yeah.
You know, just keep moving forward. I know that we're all going to die. I take time to enjoy life as well as a result. And I really try and be present in my life. But those are probably the big traits that I would be proud to be described by.
Yeah. At the start of the pandemic, you started a daily podcast, getting very ambitious there, that you've transitioned now into Chasing Life, which everyone watching and listening can go check out wherever podcasts are listened to. And that you're doing more exploring there of pushing those boundaries. A recent episode about psychedelics, which are becoming all the rage. I know here in Colorado, where I am, we just passed a law or approved passing a law to allow ketamine and MDMA and therapy. Where do you see Chasing Life fitting into the medical world versus the lay world, the layperson world?
I think it is a bridge. I think in some ways it's a podcast manifestation of what I've tried to do through books and through television and other things, is that, you know, I mean, fundamentally, this is always one of those sort of humbling things, but like, I report on all these things. I didn't actually do those studies. I didn't do that work. I'm simply trying to tell the stories of the people who did.
Yeah.
and trying to explain it. Again, that explanatory journalism. And I think Chasing Life is sort of that way as well. Whether, you know, this most recent episode about psychedelics, but really understanding what does psilocybin do to the brain? Mm. Like, how is, everyone knows selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs. Okay, so that's an interesting thing, that serotonin sticking around longer can help you feel better from depression. How does psilocybin fit into that? How does ketamine fit into that? And why is ketamine called a rescue, suicide rescue drug? So if you explain the how of things and the why of things, people are more likely to remember those things. And that's, I think, what Chasing Life is really about. Or, you know, a lot of the themes this season were just about the senses and how we actually all sense the world. Fit very well into my deep love of the brain. But also this recognition that, Ryan, you and I are talking on a Zoom call right now. We can see each other, but we're having a totally different experience.
Yeah.
You know, what you see exactly, what you hear, how the air feels around you, what you've tasted recently. I mean, just our sensory bubble, our Umwelt, is something that's just always fascinated me. German word for sensory bubble, according to Ed Yong. It's just a chance to explore these things that I've always been interested in, but be that bridge between what the medical world knows and is investigating and learning and everyone else.
Yeah. As we wrap up here, what final words of wisdom do you have for this pre-med student, this budding medical student, budding healthcare professional who may have aspirations to be you in the future?
Well, be careful what you wish for. That's what I would say. I think what I do for a living, you know, may not even be a thing in 10, 15 years. It'll be something else. Yeah. And I think that's the first thing I would say, is that many of the jobs, or many of the specific jobs or specific ways that you'll spend your time, are maybe things that haven't even been thought of yet. So, you know, in that sense, do widen the aperture, you know, in terms of how you think about medicine and the career. But I, you know, as someone who's truly straddled two different worlds of media and medicine, I've chosen to continue to make and keep medicine a huge part of my life. You know, I operate every week. I'm seeing patients in the office every week. I make rounds, all that, because I love it. And because as I've traveled the world and seen all these different sectors of society, being a doc, being in the healthcare profession is the most rewarding. There's no question about it. You cannot duplicate that in anywhere else that I can think of in life. I mean, it's not to minimize other careers by any means, but days I'm operating, days I'm seeing patients, I spring out of bed in the morning. I know what I'm on earth for those days. I know my purpose. And, you know, you want that. Obviously, if you're a pre-med or you're a medical student, that's what you anticipate that's driving you. But I'm telling you, it's true. 30 years later, and for a lot of people who said this in other fields, that daily satisfaction starts to wear down a bit more quickly. Taking care of humans, being given that awesome responsibility, there's nothing like it in the world.
All right, there you have it. Again, Dr. Sanjay Gupta. You can find his podcast. You can find his podcast, Chasing Life with Dr. Sanjay Gupta, anywhere you listen to podcasts like this one. Go take a listen to it. Hope you have a great week. We'll see you next time here on The Pre-Med Years.
This is MedEd Media.